You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 21st, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Adolph Reed, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of his latest, The South, Jim Crow, and Its Afterlives. Meanwhile, confirmation hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson begin today and are in fact underway at this very moment in the wake of a report that Clarence Thomas is hospitalized with an infection but is recovering. Missed it by that much. Ukraine rejects Russian demand for surrender in Mariupol. Biden warns China of consequences if it aids Russian invasion. Speaking of which, Biden to visit Poland now as part of his European tour. A witness claims that Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, was one of the planners to have the rally marches march upon the Capitol. Mail-in ballot rejection surge in Texas with, surprise, surprise, a racial gap. It's been 70 degrees warmer than normal in Antarctica. 70 degrees warmer than normal in Antarctica. And scientists are flabbergasted. One dead, 27 wounded in a shooting at an Arkansas car show. AstraZeneca says they have a treatment for Omicron subvariants. And lastly, 500 steelworkers at a Chevron California refinery are preparing to strike. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. We are we've been watching the opening speeches, wines in some instance of the Supreme Court hearings. Joining me, of course, Emma Vigeland.
Hello.
Emma.
And by wines, you mean like the way that Lindsey Graham was whining like a baby as opposed to, you know, it's a party. I'm drinking wine at the confirmation hearings. That might be better.
I don't know what happened. I don't know what they have underneath their desks, you know, in terms of like what they do before they head in. But yes. In fact, we have one of those wines from Lindsey Graham right now. Here is Lindsey Graham in his opening statements addressing Ketanji Brown Jackson, telling her what this hearing's not going to be.
Before they shut down the place, so that's off to a good start. Most of us couldn't go back to our offices during Kavanaugh without getting spit on. Hope that doesn't happen to y'all. I don't think it will. As to the historic nature of...
Pause it for 1 second.
Did someone spit on Lindsey Graham? Did I miss that news story?
That was, well, most of us. And yeah. By most of us, he means none of us. This has always been like the classic story that is often more apocryphal, right? Now, we were spit on our way back to our offices for supporting Kavanaugh, just because it was quite clear he was lying through his teeth.
Like they were returning from Saigon or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've been spit on. I got spit on at a Trump rally. I'm not going to shoehorn it into every conversation.
It's a marketing opportunity, Emma.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I want to be clear about something about the Kavanaugh
thing. How do I modify it? How do I get an NFT of me getting spit on?
I don't even know what that would be, but I'm sure somebody will oblige.
Someone, do it.
I just want to be clear about something with Kavanaugh. we can't know for absolute certainty about the allegations against Kavanaugh in terms of the sexual assault that he was accused of. But if any human being above the age of, I don't know, pick it, 16, thinks that he was telling the truth when he talked about what he had written in his yearbook about that woman, and I that was supposedly his friend, that I can't remember what it was, and it's not even really important, but it was quite clear, yeah, some type of reference to, you know,
was it the Boof thing?
Partying.
I can't even remember. Yeah, it was some reference to, like, you know, when they were in high school, that maybe she had, you know, fooled around or had sex with, you know,
Renata Lumnius.
Yes, yes. All these people who had fooled around, that's a euphemism, with a specific woman. Look, high school kids, with all due respect to those who are watching and to the ones I have at home, it can be idiots. But the point is not whether a high school kid can be an idiot. It's whether a grown man or woman, for that matter, can own it and not lie in front of a committee that's determining whether they should be one of nine people who have an inordinate amount of power over our society.
No, he went the opposite direction. He went into
full on denial. But the bizarre thing about that moment,
and that appealed to Republicans, by the way.
The stunning thing about that moment was there couldn't have been a single human being in that room, including his wife, including every person who sat on that committee, who didn't know that he was lying. And yet everybody pretended like it wasn't. And that was like, that for me was one of the most disturbing moments, because it became clear that they were going to adopt the Donald Trump, MO, which is not to say that ideologically or anything else or a lot of other things that, you know, Donald Trump was just a natural progression of the Republican Party. But this was the first moment where I just thought, like, we're going to take a complete and blatant lie, and we're going to be vociferous about it
indignant and furious that you would even ask this of me, especially what was so jarring too about that, if people remember, was in the wake of Christine Blasey Ford's incredibly powerful testimony. Again, we can never know for sure, as you say, but she was consistent. Her therapist notes were consistent, and she was brave. And like, then the U.S. Senate sided with the indignant one.
Right. And the indignant about something that, I mean, that one moment, everybody knew he was lying.
What's that thing from the Iraq War era where it's like, we create our own reality?
They said, you guys are part of the reality based community.
Right.
We opt out. We create our own. All right, continue with Lindsey Graham, because it was very hard for him. This is a wonderful opportunity for me to talk about how oppressed I am.
This is going to be about your philosophy. The bottom line here is, when it is about philosophy, when it's somebody of color on our side, it's about we're all racist if we ask hard questions. It's not going to fly with us. We're used to it by now, at least I am. So it's not going to matter a bit to any of us. We're going to ask you what we think you need to be asked. And Senator Hawley, you need to ask her about her record as a district court judge. You should. I hope you do. And we'll see what she says. Very fair game. Now, President Biden had a choice here, and he has every right to make it. Elections have consequences. He had many qualified African-American women to choose from. He chose you. Michelle Childs, a district court judge from South Carolina, supported by Jim Clyburn. That was in the mix. I think it came down to about two, three, four people. Don't know for sure, but that's what the press was reporting. And when it came to Judge Childs, this Arabella group, Senator Whitehouse, you talk about dark money, you may be onto something. This Arabella group is funded by Soros and some other liberal billionaire. They got so many groups in their group, I can't name them all now. But they basically said, if you pick Childs, you may have a primary opponent. The FL-CIO said,
Justice. One second. You know, one of the key elements of dark money is that
you can't identify it.
You can't identify where it comes from. Now, apparently, he's been able to identify the group and who funds it and all of it. So,
and their demands.
And their demands.
And he's like, just before we get past it, when he's teeing up Holly there, over the weekend, Holly made some comments about how Ketanji Brown Jackson is.
We're going to go through that. Okay. We got the. We
he's will. Supportive of sex offenders, but it's just like his. He's like making Fair sure game. He gets his QAnon campaign speech in and just priming him for that to happen. So.
Judge Chow was a union buster. The attacks from the left against Judge Chow's was really pretty vicious, to be honest with you.
Oh.
So you say, Judge Jackson, you don't have any judicial philosophy per se. Well, somebody on the left believes you do. Or they wouldn't have spent the money they spent to have you in this chair. So we're going to find out how that statement holds up over time. A viewer's guide to this hearing. She will be asked about her sentencing practices as a district court judge, and she'll have a chance to explain her reasoning, and you can make up for yourself what this means, but it's good to be asked. About her legal views, I'll ask her about the law of armed conflict and her view of the law of armed conflict. The fact that you represent a Gitmo detainees is not a problem with me. Everybody deserves a lawyer. You're doing the country a great service when you defend the most unpopular people. But I do want to know about your amicus briefs after you're no longer a defense counsel weighing into the Supreme Court about how they decide law of war issues. That matters a lot to me. I think it does matter that the groups that came to your aid at the expense of Judge Childs, how did that happen and why were they doing what they were doing? What is it about your nomination that the most liberal people under umbrella of Arabella threw in their money, their time, their support, and threatened Joe right. Biden? If he,
here's I my mean, here, well, listen, I have a prediction here. Well, one, obviously, he's already said why they didn't they came out against Childs because she was a union buster. He's answered his own question, but I am going to make one of my famous predictions, and that is you're going to hear the words Arabella so much in the future that you're going to get nauseous how many times you see it. It's going to be like it's going to be the new boogeyman for a period
Acorn.
Of time. Yeah, exactly. So be prepared, ladies and gentlemen.
And right. So like the no. So he's going to hang his hat on like, why didn't you pick my guy, my guy, basically my judge, which is, you know, silly. But there were groups that were in favor of Childs versus Ketanji Brown Jackson because they were more she's more conservative. So there we go. As you say, he answered his own question. But.
All right. We're going to take a break and do some ads in a moment, and hopefully when we come back from break after the ads, we'll have Professor Reed. First, we're in the new year. I just got saved by this stuff the other day. I went out with a friend I haven't seen in about 15 years, and we got a little bit carried away. In terms of the drinking, of course, I immediately, when I come home, it's like I've trained my mind now.
Liquid IV.
One stick of liquid IV, 16 ounces of water, hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. And in the morning, I didn't feel 100%, but I did not feel around 22% where I anticipated. Liquid IV has incredible hydration flavors like watermelon, lemon, lime, strawberry, pina colada, and more. Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sport drinks. Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients and is non-GMO. It is free from gluten, free from dairy, free from soy. It has this thing called the science of cellular transport technology. Basically, it just means that you get more absorption in your body of the water and other ingredients into the bloodstream. Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company has donated over 19 million servings globally. Apparently, this year is going to be the highest airline travel since 2019. And also, liquid IV is great when you're flying around. You get dehydrated up there. Take a couple of packets with you on your road trip, on your whatever you wherever you're going. I guess I don't know where do people go places anymore. I have no idea. But liquid IV, one of the staples around the office here. We got multiple flavors. I like the. I'm really like I have not gotten off the tangerine. I'm still on that still on big that? Time, yeah. But. The matcha, my substitute for coffee at times. So check it out. Grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you go 25% off. When you go to liquidiv.com, use the code MajorityRep at checkout. It's 25% off anything when you order and use the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today at liquidiv.com. Promo code Majority Rep. Also, we got a new sponsor, and I actually sort of I never really contemplated outdoor furniture, right? Like I go out, I have a friend who has a outdoor space in Brooklyn, which is fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Luxury.
Yes, it is. And that's why like one of the few friends I maintained through the years
I get to do that. Yeah.
93% of life apparently spent indoors. So when you finally get a moment to go out in the fresh air, you got to make it count. The warm weather has arrived. I was sitting out there and, I, for the first time I noticed what do you call it?
The setup.
Yeah. The outdoor furniture, I guess. I never really contemplated it, but it makes a big difference when you got really nice outdoor furniture. Outer is an innovative, high-quality outdoor furniture designed to look and feel great. You can create your own backyard resort with everything from teak chairs to fire pit tables. Both the teak chairs and the fire pit tables, that would be my fantasy, to have like an outdoor space with teak chairs and a fire pit. But I don't have outdoor space in Brooklyn. Wow, that's not. Every outer piece is made from sustainable materials. It comes with patented built-in cover for effortless protection, all for less than you pay at a big box store. And the outer furniture comes with best-in-class warranties. They have 10 years for their chic aluminum line and a two-week trial with free returns. That's awesome. See the difference at liveouter.com/majority. Plus, for a limited time, you get $300 off and free shipping. This is Outer's best offer anywhere, only available to podcast listeners. And only for a limited time, get $300 off and free shipping at liveouter, LiveOuter, liveouter.com/majority. liveouter.com/majority. Terms and conditions apply as always. And as always, we'll put that link in our podcast and YouTube description. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Adolf Reed, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland. I couldn't even get my own name out. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I'd like to welcome back to the show after too long of a time, Professor Adolf Reed. He is a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives. Professor Reed, welcome back to the program.
Oh, well, yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
So now I was trying to figure out how to characterize your book, and I came up with autoethnography, and it is basically your you know, stories of your experience living under Jim Crow, mm-hmm. Then making observations and arguments surrounding that in terms of how it functioned, expressing that sort of daily life under Jim Crow. I want to start with something that's fairly remedial for folks.
Okay.
Will you describe for us, like, what is, when we say Jim Crow, this is coming mm-hmm. out of Reconstruction. And what are we talking about?
Well, it's really even a little later than Reconstruction. I mean, I define it really, pardon me, my allergies are killing me, as the social order based on codified racial subordination and the white supremacy that took shape in most of the South after the defeat of the populist insurgency in the early 1890s. Not even racial segregation carried the kind of systemic meanings prior to, you know, say, 1890 that it did after. If you take, for instance, segregation in public transportation, Charles Lofgren in a book called The Plessy Case is really does really great work on this. That between emancipation and the Plessy Case, states and localities across the South, in some places, imposed segregation laws and then got rid of them and reimposed them. In some places, they didn't have them. In some places, they didn't have them and then imposed them and then got rid of them. In some places, they applied to trolleys, but not to steamboats. But in some places, vice versa. So the regime of racial segregation, as we typically think of it, didn't become consolidated as a political or as a politically significant thing for whites or blacks on a large scale till the 1890s. So I would say, I would delimit the Jim Crow era basically as having formed and consolidated someplace between 1890 and World War I, depending on where you were, and having begun to break down indirectly after World War II, and at the back of it, as I pointed, or the back of it, as I pointed out often, was broken by the time I was 18 years old, 1965.
We were trying to figure out who it was that we interviewed, who had talked about the coups that took place during Reconstruction mm-hmm. in South Carolina as a right. function of white plantation owners realizing that they could not motivate Appalachians enough over race to break up the populists and, forming a political alliance with essentially newly freemen. And that they ended up resorting to violence there, is it your sense that to the extent that it begins to congeal, that Jim Crow laws were a function of that? I mean, I feel like that's a big part of your argument, is that it shows it is not that the racial elements of it in terms of intent or motivation were second order for an agenda that sort of precedes it.
Oh yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think you're probably thinking about North Carolina instead of South Carolina, because in North Carolina, in the midst of pushback against populism, a statewide populist Republican fusion government, what was elected in 1894 and then reelected by bigger margins in 1896. And that's what prompted the putsch led by the Democratic Party in 1898, when a few years later, former Governor Aycock commented that, that we need the strength that comes from thinking all alike. And what that meant, of course, was all white people. And what that also meant was the Democratic Party, which he also said, the Democratic Party alone is sufficient to meet our needs. But and the fact is, and look, I know for most people in this country, you know, what happened before Martin Luther King, or the image of about Martin Luther King, was a kind of indistinguishable blur of the bad old timey times, right? From slavery to whatever came after slavery, which some people argue was worse than slavery. But I think it's more useful for us to think of the 30 years between, or say the 30 years after emancipation in 1865, as kind of a period of flux, or even if you will, kind of an interregnum, right, between two orders. You know, on which there was political contestation at the grassroots level, from the grassroots level up, about what the reconstructed South was going to be, what the status of blacks who are now technically citizens in Southern political economy and Southern life was going to be. And it's also the case that the planter, merchant, capitalist class seemed, in retrospect, irrationally fearful of that possibility that you mentioned, right? That broken working class whites and blacks would align to overthrow them. And if we think about how, you know, what the upper class sense of being overthrown is today, the stakes are pretty low, right? But just as they are now, right? It was just as say, the likes of Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, think that having to pay taxes is like going on a forced march to Treblinka.
Right.
Right. But they were kind of like that then, too. So in addition to what happened in North Carolina in the mid-1890s, in Virginia in 1879, a similar kind of coalition was elected statewide and elected at the leadership, ironically, or maybe not, of a former Confederate general named Mahone, took state power for a while in Virginia and passed a bunch of downwardly redistributive laws. But even beyond that, I mean, William H. Freeling's book, South Against the South, chronicles, the almost 300,000 white Southerners who didn't support the Confederacy and 100,000 or more who actively fought for the Union against secession, and the wonderful historian Victoria Bynum study what I did a book on that topic too, but in addition she did the study of the Free State of Jones, which Gary Ross turned into a very much underappreciated film, but about a county in Mississippi of all places that seceded from the Confederacy, and where like an interracial army of white farmers and black runaways fought alongside the Union against the Confederacy. So it's not exactly that the governing class fears of this potential alliance were irrational. It's only from the later perspective, after two or three generations of imposition of solid South ideology, that we might think that that all white people thought the same thing, basically. But the fact was that they, and the populist insurgency just brought home to them that they really needed to do something about this once and for all. And the last thing I'll say about this is that it's noteworthy that disfranchisement happened after the defeat of populism. And not only 90% plus of all blacks were disfranchised, but depending on where you were, between a quarter to a third of whites were also disfranchised. And the result of it was that the center of gravity of Southern politics shifted sharply to reflect the interests of the ruling class, right? Or the capitalist and plantation upper class. And when people ask, and this is the last thing I'll say, but when people, seek for reasons that say trade unionism is so much weaker in the South than it is elsewhere, American academics tend to adduce culturalist explanations, right? So stuff like something about Southern culture or endemic commitment to white supremacy or whatever. Fact is, you don't need to look any farther than disfranchisement, because because after the center of gravity of the southern electorate shifted sharply toward the propertied classes, there was no space for the emergence of a governor, John Altgeld, for instance, like in Illinois, who supported the Haymarket, prisoners, right, like against the owners, right, or like other governors and mayors and councils who were pro-labor and supported trade unionism. Because in the South, like every level of government was totally committed to and owned by, the ownership class. So guess what happens?
So the disenfranchisement that we saw through, literacy tests, mm-hmm. or whatnot, right. or poll taxes, they disenfranchise black people writ large, and then basically poor whites, who are and this is almost like a rear guard action to sort of shut the door once they're in power. I mean, we
right? No, exactly. That's a good way to put it. Yeah,
we sort of have a contemporary model for this.
Right.
Yep. People are wondering. I mean, we're literally watching this. I feel like in real time. This is they get into they have the Supreme Court and that door gets shut again. To make sure that this gets locked in.
Right. Well, and look, I mean, that's one of the differences between right and left in this country at this point, right? At least, or what I often refer to now as whatever that thing is that occupies a cultural space that a left would occupy in the U.S. if there were one, right? Right. Because the right has a vision that they're mobilizing around, and they want to impose it, and they want to make the world in their image, where the left has no vision, so we don't think to do stuff like that. But I want to say one thing about the disfranchisement thing too, or disfranchisement comparison too, if you don't mind. And it's this, like, and I've been hammering on this point in my classes for a while, and I think it's useful, for us all, to reflect on it for a moment or two. That disfranchisement in 2020, much like disfranchisement in 1895, was a means to an end. And certainly it was part of the fabric of white supremacy or the restoration of absolute governing class power under the sign of white supremacy at the end of the 19th century. But if blacks had voted dependably Democratic, by some percentage, not even a majority necessarily, then the white supremacists or the reimposition of absolute class power under the sign of white supremacy would probably have happened anyway, but it's less likely that disfranchisement would have been one of its principal weapons, right? And by the same token now, and I just wrote something about this with respect to Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina. She's gotten quite huffy when people in South Carolina have suggested that there's a racial motive that underlies their attempts to purify the electorate and to suppress voting. And I'm sure that she's sincere, at least in the sense that people believe what they need to believe to do what they need to get done. But she could be sincere in another more plausible sense, too, in that it's easy to see that now, and a lot of Republicans would say this themselves, including Haley, she's shown it, that if more black people voted Republican, disfranchisement wouldn't, or that kind of disfranchisement, racialized disfranchisement, wouldn't necessarily be the mechanism of choice to close the door and to lock in class power now. So what's my point there? Well, my point there is that, as I said about the Jim Crow South, while on one level, obviously and clearly, indisputably, race was and racism was what drove the Jim Crow order, but on another level, it really wasn't about race at all.
Okay, so in, yeah. if I understand you, it's that the disenfranchisement would not be the arrow if black people voted for Republicans. Now they're not going to,
right,
in the numbers that they want, but right, it, the fact that it's really just like, how do we maintain power? And this right is the low hanging fruit. It is
right. No, that's right.
And it's also the, and I want to actually get into, you know, some of the aspects of the book, but in a moment, mm-hmm, this is sort of, I guess, surrounds it too. I mean, I just read it's also sort of, that utility is also there to fight that disenfranchisement. In other words, I just read, I have a headline, that in Texas, where they've reinstituted, where they've instituted this sort of mail-in ballot, right, they've changed the laws, and the spoiled vote, tally has gone from like 1% to like 30%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they're also finding a racial gap here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that headline, without the racial gap, it doesn't seem to gain as much traction,
mm-hmm,
as the one with the racial gap. But it's still
right
equally anti-democratic.
Right.
Small
right
team,
that's right.
And
right
it's still extremely problematic, and it's still going to empower the Republicans in their agenda. But part of it is that, like, we didn't have a 1965 for, you know, for white people. Women had
right
their vote, you know,
right,
20, 30, 40 years earlier. And so it doesn't have the same resonance to just say, like, hey, wait a second, there's clearly voter disenfranchisement here.
Right.
But without the sort of racial, it doesn't resonate in the same way. And it's just sort of like, this is just the easiest way for them to do it. I mean, I think guy,
yeah,
there was a guy caught on camera by, I think, mm-hmm, like the Daily Show, a North Carolina official who's like,
right,
yeah, well, of course we did that because we didn't right want the black people to vote. And it's because, you know, they're Democrats.
Right. There's one of the morons like in North Carolina actually wrote to the Justice Department and asked for a list of precincts where blacks predominated. And then they produced a redistricting plan that disfranchised all those precincts. So it was so transparent there. It's too stupid to live, basically. But I see where you're going with this. And look, I mean, this is part of the Catch-22, man. I agree. In the midst of the street fight, you pick up whatever's around that you can use, right? But again, this takes us back to the problem that I mentioned at the beginning, that the right has some place that they're trying to go. So they will make use of the low-hanging fruit, but they'll connect that in one way or another, in whatever ways, mainly through the improvisational dynamics of coalition formation. They'll connect that to this strategy for getting to where they want to get ultimately, right? And you put your thumb on the problem too, that the only language that we have legally to protest inequality is a language based on what I've described as categories of ascriptive difference, like categories based on what you supposedly are instead of what you do. So race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And that kind of feeds the disparitarian understanding of what inequality is, right? But that all depends on, or the success of that approach depends not on building a broad political alliance to challenge for power, but it depends on appellants having the ear of the sympathetic voices in the ruling class, in the courts, in Congress, or whatever, who can make things happen, you know, outside of a majoritarian context. And we can't, you know, we haven't been able to depend on that for 30 years, right? And we certainly can't now. And that's why I think that part of what has to happen, and this is what, pardon the shameless plug, but our podcast, classmatters.org, or the Class Matters podcast, is focused on, well, I mean, our tagline is what would the country look like if it were governed by and for the working class? And we're trying to find ways to start, you know, getting around the identitarian, you know, roadblocks, and sort of catching working people before they get drawn into Trumpism, basically. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah. Do you feel like, I mean, the flattening, I guess, of that, those power dynamics exacerbates or even worsens, you know, some of the ways that the right has been able to make gains with voter suppression, like in this current day? I mean, I know that the history of it, that might be part of, you know, why it's such an uphill battle right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. So what do you mean by flattening of the power dynamics?
Yeah, just like making it, you know, more only about anti-racism.
Oh, yeah.
The class, right.
Yeah. I think absolutely. And in fact, a good friend and colleague of mine in South Carolina, and I did an article. He did most of the work, actually, a few years ago on this. After working in South Carolina for a long time and noticing that Democrats and Republicans, black and white, are equally committed to race being the central fault line for political differentiation in the state. My colleague, the professor Willie Leggett, who, I mean, by the way, like if there were a Nobel Prize for apathems, he would have won it for saying a few years ago that the only thing that hasn't changed about black politics since 1965 is how we think about it. And he's absolutely correct about that. But like he went back to V.O. Key's classic study of Southern politics in 1949 called Southern Politics in State and Nation, and found the pages where Key describes the role that race played in South Carolina politics in 1949. And what we figured out was with a very small handful of individual word changes, right? In those passages, you could say just about the same thing about South Carolina race and South Carolina politics now, that it's used as what the Field Sisters called a surface camouflage to conceal the political, economic, and class dynamics that are really driving driving the society. And I think that's true nationally. And, you know, like for something else I was just trying to work on, I was trying to find out that apparently the Census Bureau stopped keeping records on labor force participation by race at some point before 2020. So it's just all about, and even when you look at local economic data, under the economy, what you see is like businesses, but you got to do some extra digging around to find out anything about employment. So this is like part of a bipartisan program, basically, to make the working class disappear. It's also part of the contemporary anti-racist program, right? I mean, since 2016, the black chattering class and as best exemplified by Joanne Reed, like on MSNBC, has been insisting that working class is a euphemism for white racist, which means, among other things, you can't be black and be in a working class. You can only be black. And to the extent that the so-called black agenda is set by the investor class, well, we kind of see how that plays out, don't we? Right. That's where the wealth gap comes from, despite the fact that we know that 3/4 of so-called black wealth is held by the 10% or the richest 10% of black people, and 3/4 of so-called white wealth is held by the richest 10% of white people, and the bottom half of blacks and whites have no wealth whatsoever, and 96% of black wealth is held by the richest 20% of black people. So what does narrowing the wealth gap do for anybody who has to work for a living? So So yeah, like it's from all around us, right? And that's the reason that my colleagues and I have been describing anti-racist discourse as a species of neoliberalism at this point.
I mean, it's interesting. The I don't know if it's the irony, but the man, it's certainly not a coincidence, maybe. But the when you talk about Joyanne Reed or any folks who are using, you know, who perceive the working class as just white supremacists, it excludes black working class people. It also happens on the other side, I think, where people are arguing, like, you know, you have some people who are arguing Democrats need to appeal more to working class.
Right.
Some of those people are basically just also, it seems to me, erasing black working class people.
Right.
It's a project that really brings people together, I guess.
I tell you, that's like a throwback. That's a very important point too, Sam. And that's like a throwback to that moment at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s when in the earlier incarnation of Clintonism, right, a chunk of the driving line was that the Democrats needed to get away from, you know, from their association with minorities, labor, and feminists, right? And this is just another version of the same thing. So yeah, there's a Scylla and a Charybdis out there, and we have to navigate very carefully through the strait between them.
Well, because you did say identitarian roadblocks, and is that what you mean there? That this is just like it's a distraction or it's a misdirection on some level, and we can't address the underlying sort of, or we can't even see necessarily the underlying dynamic if because we're making some type of category error, I guess, in terms of like what is driving.
Yes, I would say that. And I would also say that burned into my brain is the image of, what's his name? Van Jones falling to his knees and weeping when he got that $100 million check from Jeff Bezos, right? I mean, this is a class program, right? It's a class politics that's dressed up as a race politics, which is what race politics always is. It was late 19th century white supremacy was a class politics dressed up as a race politics. Early 21st century anti-racist politics is a different kind of class politics dressed up as a different kind of race politics.
So where does, and I...
I like how we're naming names on the show today.
Oh, well, I distinctly
Oh, I'm
remember,
old. That's what old people do. So I'm just channeling my grandmother.
Van Jones once. I remember this very distinctly because I did it in my basement. It was just when this was an audio show only. And he had just spoken at Netroots Nation. This must have been 10 years ago or 8 years ago. And it was developing he wanted to create a group to fight like the Tea Party. He was sort of in a stage where he was challenging Glenn Beck. And I remember distinctly asking him, like, okay, so who's the enemy here? Like, I mean, who is doing it? There is no enemy, I think is what he said. And I was just like, wait, what? How do you, what? This is all just sort of like the weather? Like, I don't understand.
I tell you what, man, like when I worked in Manhattan and lived partly in New Haven, every day on your Metro North in Stamford, or between Stamford and Greenwich, I would ride past, you know, on a train the world, I mean, headquarters of WWE, the World Wrestling Enterprise, and that's what that politics is to me. But that's what Van Jones, I mean, debating Glenn, what Glenn Beck is basically, it's theater.
Well, but let me speak in defense of WWE.
Well, in fact, they should have debated in Jell-O.
That's part of that's part of what, you know, what we do here is partly that element. But like at the very least, do it well, in my estimation. Right. Like there has to be some value to it. If you're not, all he's doing is fighting Glenn Beck. He's not fighting what Glenn Beck stands for. Is problematic. That was my issue with it. Like, I don't mind the theater. I do also remember one time I was on a program where I was sitting next to a guy who I only knew him as a fundraiser for Obama. We got into a big argument about the estate tax. And he was saying, like, the estate tax is hindering intergenerational wealth transfer.
Oh, my God.
People. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And we got into, like, this,
oh my God,
protracted argument that happened. And he's like, the Congressional Black Caucus supports it. And we're arguing. And I'm like, I don't care who supports it. It's ridiculous. We're arguing through the commercial break. And it wasn't until afterwards when I got home that I Googled the guy and found out that he was, like number one or two, like, wealthiest black men in the entire country. Like, he was worried about his kids getting the full, like, you know, like, they're going to lose out on, they're only going to get like 30 or 50 million each, you know, if these taxes go through. And I was just like, wow. All right. Well, so you write that there's like almost like two opposite misunderstandings of Jim Crow to get back into this, because this is, what were they or what are they?
Well, yeah, one is the happy faced one, right? That it solved all of our problems and there's no more inequality that's unjust anymore, right?
The end of Jim Crow. Okay.
Right. And the other is that the victories didn't amount to anything, right? That they didn't mean anything. And I've been hearing the latter, line pop up, especially among young people, because, you know, young people don't know anything, but they think they know a whole lot, for 30 years now. And my knee-jerk reaction has always been, God, I wish I had a Wayback Machine, and I could drop you, like, in the Mississippi Delta in 1950 and then come back 6 weeks later and pick you up, right? So there's that kind of misunderstanding. And the other misunderstanding, I guess, is more, or is either more naive or naive in a different way, but it stems from, partly, from a fundamental misunderstanding of the roots of inequality, even those inequalities that manifest as racial, right? And my friend, the historian Barbara Jean Fields, has often said that For a long time now, the way that people in this country talk about slavery or Jim Crow, one would think that the point was to produce racism, right? Not, you know, cotton and rice and sugarcane, right? So we've kind of inverted the understanding of the relation between racial bigotry and the social order out of which racial bigotry emerges and makes sense. And I think one of the things I've tried to convey in the book is that, race is an ideology. It's not a thing, of course. It's historically specific. It comes into existence in certain historical moments and political economic contexts. And while the word stays pretty much the same, the content that attaches to the word changes, right, over time. And race or racism fundamentally cannot cause anything because they're abstract ideas that don't have the capacity to make anything happen, right? What the ideologies appeal to people because they emerge out of a sort of common sense cauldron, right? But such that you look around and see who is positioned where in the social hierarchy. And race is a taxonomic discourse that provides a natural seeming explanation for why who is wherever they are should be there, right? It's supposed to be there. And like all such ideologies, it gains currency and becomes dominant when it comports with the sensibilities of powerful interests, right, in the society who want to propagate it and use it.
If racism did not provide the desired outcome by wealthy people, they would move on to something else.
Totally.
Okay. So here's my dilemma, and then I can bring it back to Jim Crow.
Oh yeah, sure.
But here's so I subscribe to that notion, and in some ways I think everybody a lot of anti-racists do too, and don't necessarily realize. I mean, because you always hear like nobody's born racist; you're taught to be racist.
Right.
Well, if that's the case, the question is like, why? And and if it's not endemic, the question is like, why are you being taught to be racist? And it is, you know, it may on the micro level have be like, well, it's a tradition in our family, you know, we like to be racist. But somebody was taught to be racist, and it was used as a tool. Mm-hmm. But does that mean? But it doesn't necessarily follow that if racism is taught to be a tool, that you can bypass the implications of that belief system that has now been reproduced for the benefit of maintaining a power dynamic that has to do with money and class.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily follow that you can bypass that and just deal directly with power in terms of money and class,
or you
need to sort of like go back in, like almost like, you know, I turn my shirt inside out. I gotta turn it back inside in before I can put it on.
Well, I know that's what a lot of anti-racist educators and like others say. A lot of anti-racist activists. What somebody I read not that long ago said that you know, our job is as progressive activists or as leftists is to win white people to the understanding of how they've messed over black people. But the question that you ask really gets down to an organizing question. Right. And I think that you kind of split the difference between the two approaches that you suggest. Right. That to build a broad alliance, right? Well, it's like trying to organize a shop, basically, right? That you start out from the issues and concerns that people have in common, right? And through the course of struggling to advance those issues and concerns, both in a positive sense and, of course, in a negative one too, that then you build the kinds of solidarities that make it easier to confront directly the vestiges or the more than vestiges, the actual bigoted sensibilities that individual people have. And I mean, a couple things about that. One is that, you know, that's an approach that doesn't begin from the assumption that to build a movement, you got to turn people into saints first, basically. As I've often said, it's not like we're trying to pledge a frat here, right? Or to rush a frat, like we're trying to. So we don't need everybody to believe the same thing coming in, right? The point is that through the course of building and broadening the struggle, people come to see things differently. And like, this is the petty comparison, I suppose. Some people might think it's kind of romantic, but I mentioned this at least once or twice in the book, that at this point, right, for the last 30 years, right, I have noticed, I've sometimes registered, when I see, you know, interracial groups of people out in the South, friends, coworkers, neighbors, whatever, you know, having drinks at a TGI Fridays or at a softball game together, you know, I recall that this is a level of sort of almost trivial but mundane interaction that would not have been possible as early or as late as 1960, at least. And that was partly the point of Jim Crow. Like when we, you know, started working and organizing campaign in South Carolina in 2006, we spent a lot of time working flea markets, which are, you know, working class shopping malls, basically. And we were struck right away at how much evidence there was of current and former, like, interracial coupling, right? But in that place, I mean, what I often mention is one woman, like a grandmother, a white grandmother who looked like she was straight out of the uprising of 34, sitting with her little mixed race black grandbaby, and and much greater, copious, right, evidence, right, all up and down the working class. And I was reminded that, Pitchfork, Ben Tillman and Cole Blees and those guys knew what they were doing because they understood that when people are in common circumstances, it's as likely that they will align, which is, after all, the thing they'd been frightened to death of since 1865. It's more likely that they'll align on their own than not. So the focal point of politics comes to center on making sure that they don't align. And that's what's coming from the right now, too.
So okay. And when you put it in the context of organizing and in a shop, it makes a lot of sense to me, right? You don't come in and highlight any, the differences. You highlight shared experiences that everybody's having in there. Right. And allow those shared experiences to overcome any type of, prejudice or predispositions or racial animus or whatever it is over time.
Right.
But in terms of like sort of, the 20,000 foot type of thing, like where it's not from as an organizing, let's say, tactic, but in terms of a, I guess like a sort of broader intellectual fight to influence maybe marginally like legislation or regulation that will set up, make it easier for you to walk into that shop as like you say, you're in a street fight, you pick up the first thing you see. How is it problematic on that level? Right. Like, I mean, how is it problematic? I mean, frankly, like when you're talking about like organizing a shop, how is it problematic that like a New York Times op-ed writer or whomever, is obscuring this dynamic, at least in that way, as obscuring really what you would do tactically or material, like in terms of what you do, as opposed to like the thoughts associated.
Well, that's important too, Sam. I mean, I'll say a couple things. One is I do see that Charles Blow gives the Boogaloo Boys bulletin board material at least once every other week. So that doesn't help us. Right. But so I think we're at a point now. Well, the thing is, we got to be able to do both things at the same time. And the problem with whatever that blob is that occupies the cultural space, et cetera, is that it doesn't do that and it hasn't done that. So much of what is represented as left politics is purely performative and frankly has a Potemkin quality, right? Like it's done to affect the cable news cycle, right now, much more than it's done, to try to generate a base and to move people. And there's often a career imperative that's involved as well, right? I mean, just look at the history of Black Lives Matter, for instance, which shouldn't have been that hard to see. But here's the thing. So like last summer, I published an article called The Whole Country is a Reichstag in Non-Site. And part of my argument there is that we may well have reached a point at which neoliberalism is no longer capable of delivering enough for enough of the population to sustain its legitimacy as a nominally democratic order. And in that case, what happens is like, so when I go for a walk here, there's like a T intersection about three blocks from my apartment. So I think about it every day. That we may well be at the political equivalent of a T intersection where there's only two directions to go. One is right, and that's toward authoritarianism. And the other is at least in a kind of New Dealish social, democratic sensibility that would encourage toward a public good understanding of government. And one of the things that's definitely come through in our work, but I think it comes through from all the anti-vax stuff too, is that working people in this country have pretty much seem to have lost faith in the idea that government can do anything decent for them. And if we don't begin to restore that, right, then it doesn't matter how how the public interest groups might get Congress to, whether to move the, or to shift the playing field like two decimal points to the right in our direction, right? Because the right's still going to win, win the game ultimately. And so that's why I say we've got to be able to do both things at the same time. We've got to be able to like understand and see. This is why I thought those, I can never vote for Biden people are crazy and I'm irresponsible. And God knows what, well, I'm no fan of Joe Biden, right? Or the wing of the party that he represents. And it's an odd feeling to think that on domestic policy, the left wing of the Biden administration is represented by Brian Deese and BlackRock, the asset managers. And maybe on foreign policy, the left wing of the Biden administration might be John Mearsheimer.
Yes.
But that's the reality that we have.
There's only two directions. And we right. should say, to continue that metaphor, that it is also conceivable, people should understand that you could take that authoritarian turn and actually, improve things along the lines of anti-racism, right? Like, that would be, there would... You could theoretically
sure.
have that guy I was sitting next to. I can't – Von Peebles? Was it Peebles or something? That guy I was sitting next to on right. that show.
Yep.
He could just be like, yeah, no, I mean, we're – and I think at one point, like he did, he started like raising money for Mitt Romney. And after Obama, after the first 4 years, because he didn't get his – it was Don Peebles. And he – and theoretically – He could be okay in that authoritarian turn, as opposed to the right. And there's just nothing being offered on that level, on that plane of decision, essentially that the nominal left in this country, center to the left as we have it in this country, is offering in a concrete way. I mean, Biden seemed to make an attempt. People could argue as to, how ambitious or how sincere it was, but, Build Back Better right. was at least, providing some of that material support would have gone that way. I mean, I had so much more I wanted to ask you about,
I'm sorry, like I'm not letting us talk about the book.
This
is self-destructive behavior.
But I mean, I think a lot of these themes are sort of embedded in your experience of Jim Crow and the experience of Jim Crow. And we should say, I know you wrote this because you are, essentially the last cohort to have actually lived there. All right. Let me just ask one more question that I think will sort of like tie into this too.
Okay.
Is that, you write in the book that in the course of Jim Crow and you have this idea of like one, obviously you want to keep black people and white people separate because you don't want them saying like, hey, wait a second. Yeah, no, I have trouble making ends meet at the end of the month or this is costing too much, but also that the agenda was not to keep black people separate from the economy, but to play a specific role in that context. Will you speak to that? Because I think that sort of like bridges a little bit of what we've been saying.
Yeah. And frankly, like the view that the point of the segregationist order was to, was to exclude blacks from the society entirely has given over the years, given rise to two distinct pathologies. One of them is the view. The view that the more reasonable course for advocates of black interests, concerns, whatever, through the courts, would have been instead of challenging the legality of separate but equal on 14th Amendment grounds to focus on demanding strict enforcement of separate but equal doctrine. And I mentioned that in the book. And my point there is that, well, that just fundamentally misunderstands what the point of the regime was, right? The point of the regime, like, separate but equal is never anything more than a fig leaf, right, to get past the 14th and 15th Amendments on paper, to give Northern liberals what would a basis for winking and nodding. The other one is that blacks should secede formally or informally from the main line of the American economy and do their own thing, basically. And that fundamentally but misunderstands that actually the point of segregation, as was the point of slavery, frankly, was not to separate black people from the economic life of the nation, but was to reduce them to a labor force that had no rights, right? Much in the same way that illegal immigration works today, right? A friend of mine in the workers' center movement, what was often said to white work or to American workers or whatever color, that look, it's not that the immigrants are taking your job. What's happening is that the employer is turning your job into a job that only somebody with no rights or options whatsoever would be eligible for, right? And that's what the point of the Jim Crow system was. And that was one of the, some people call it a tragedy. I don't give them that much credit. But one of the things about the Booker T. Washington line, what was it? He convinced himself, and it was easy to convince himself because he got all the good stuff, that it was possible for blacks to abjure demands for citizenship rights, right? And in the interest, this is create a vibrant black business class, basically. Often with fantasies of of all black towns, all black states, or whatever. But that fundamentally misunderstands the relation between politics and economics. And just as it did in 1890, it does in 2022.
It just fundamentally misunderstood the fact that this is not a question of people don't want the white ruling class does not want black people around. It right. wants them around, but only to right. serve a very specific purpose.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Adolph Reed, the book is called The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives. It is, as I have deemed it, an autoethnography.
That's a lot better than memoir, so thank you very much.
Well, I know. I've heard that you don't like that. And so,
no, not at all.
But it is a view at Jim Crow from essentially the ground, and mm-hmm. And how it created these circumstances on a daily basis to achieve a lot of the things we've been talking about. I really appreciate you coming on today. It was a great pleasure to see you.
Oh, and likewise, I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks a lot for having me.
All right, folks. Thanks again. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. Look at that. It's like the Brady Bunch.
Now we're back.
There we go. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm and in our YouTube description and podcast description. Don Peebles, estimated net worth as of 2015. I think that's around when I went on with him. He was listed by Forbes as like one of the top, I don't know, 5 or 10 black moneyed people in the country. And we really got into it. I had no idea. I was just like, what are you talking about? And then I looked up and it was just basically like the dude.
It's probably better to not know that in that conversation, because then you can have the actual disagreement with him without being like, oh,
Right.
Exactly. Obvious one. Exactly. But I just like, I look back on that and I was like, you know, back at that time, I wasn't getting the couple of $100 I get when I go on now. And I realized like, yeah, no, I mean, I go on this. I mean, I enjoyed it, to be honest with you. It was like, it was, I think it was on Up, and they had free pastry, and I was well known for indulging in that. And people can imagine around here, right? Like I got, I'm like sitting in front of like a plate of like, of sugar food, and I went crazy. I got nailed eating on camera like, multiple times.
Wow.
Yeah. And,
that's my thing.
But I, you know, I realized like that dude is on there. Yeah, this is like, he's, this is about him making like money. Like it's worth it.
What
like,
he's going on cable news basically just to invest in his own,
To be fair, I mean, it's to, for his kids, right? I mean, cause he theoretically he's dead, when the estate, gets passed on. But maybe it saves him some money and hassle up front, so he doesn't have to figure out a way to avoid the estate tax by, like, you know, putting it in some type of trust in perpetuity or whatever.
Can you imagine, like, getting up in arms about your kid getting, like, 25 mil as opposed to 30? That's just, it's, like, so foreign.
Their imagination fills out what that, like, $20 million, what you can do with that a lot more than ours does.
That's the thing. I can't even absorb, like, the idea of,
like property.
And never mind, like, my kids having, like, they're only going to get 25 instead of 30 mil. Like, I can't even, like, if it was just me, I wouldn't have, like, a concept of, like, I'm pissed because I only have 25 as opposed to 30.
Well, the estate tax kicks in, what, of $2 million or more?
What? No, yeah. Now it's, like, combined. I think we're still under Trump. I think it's, a combined, like, 10 million. I mean, it has been just a complete – I mean, I don't know how – you know, I think
Bradley,
it's like a combined 10
million.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was late December. It was December 2012. It was 10 years ago. Wow.
Yeah. The estate tax is one of those policies that,
it's insane.
It's like whenever conservatives say like, why do you care so much about history? It's like, cause you're inheriting like the material gains from that history still. Like if we stop doing that sort of like inherited privilege, we could stop like maybe, I mean, obsessing about stuff so much.
But the amazing thing was the audacity he had to make this argument that it was about Black intergenerational wealth.
Yeah.
And on some level, yes, it was.
It is certainly for him.
It was, but it was just like specifically his family's intergenerational wealth. I was at the conference. This is where I was at, like the tort conference, and we didn't have camera at that time, and we just played the clip as I narrated it. Look how young everybody looks. Play a clip of it, see if you can land on it where it is. Not that part, but and here it is.
The big problem is the rate of growth of healthcare costs. I think we can all agree on that, right?
Yep.
Now, Medicare. The rate of growth.
No, it's
in
later.
Medicare
in it, I think.
Significant.
I can't remember where it gets to. Whatever. People can go look it up. I mean,
where is the guy? This.
Okay, we'll look at it. Maybe in the fun half. Ladies and gentlemen, speaking of fun. We are only 5 or 6 days away now from the first live, well, they're always live, but the first live in-person Majority Report show in over 2 years. Maybe close to 3 years, actually. I can't remember, but it is in Brooklyn. It is sold out very quickly. But you can live stream it. By going to Majority Live, clicking on the Brooklyn show, clicking on the buy a ticket for the event, and then you can buy a ticket and watch it. It's going to be, it's turning into like a cavalcade. So it's going to be a little bit crazy, but you should check it out. And it's like $12. That's ridiculous. I wish there was a way that you could get a discount. Well, there is.
Wow.
You can get $7 off that. Maybe it's $12.50. I don't know what it is. But it, you can get more than 50% off by signing up for the AM Quickie. What does it cost you to sign up for the AM Quickie? Nothing. The price is you get a great email digest of the day's news written either by Jack or Corey, switching off, every day. That's the cost. Oh, my God. This is like a win. Like, I know, win, win, win. It is like a win, 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 win. Don't make me list all of them.
Win to the 10th power.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Also, there's still tickets left for the Boston show. I don't know if John Benjamin and Larry Murphy are going to make it to the Boston show. The Bob's Burgers movie is coming out like a week later, and there are press junkets. Why am I not invited? Because people should protest that. I am in the movie, but I only have like literally like two lines. It's just the complete like playing lip service to Hugo. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. But let me tell you something. When you leave that theater, the Wilbur Theater in Boston, you're not even gonna think about that. That Benjamin and Murphy were there. Like, I don't even care. I don't even like those guys.
Who are they?
I don't even know.
Right?
You're going to walk out of there going, like, wait, what? Who cares about that because of the special guest that's there?
Whew.
So.
Secret guest.
Secret special guest. Secret special guest. Sometimes you get guests that are so big, you can't even advertise. That's the deal. It's not the president. It's not Donald Trump. So, also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And lastly, it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. It really is. You get the free show without the advertising. Trying to get more ads, but they've switched their advertising platform and this and that. So we got a little bit salamied on that, as it were, and you can help keep this show alive and surviving and thriving by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. In the meantime, what is happening in the Matt Lekian Media Enterprise?
Institute?
Empire.
Attempt. Universe. We're David Griscom and I will be back on Wednesday night. Both of us are back off our vacations now, so we'll be reunited. But go check out my interview with Carl Bayer on some of the thornier questions about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So patreon.com just left reckoning.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Fun
Hat.
Matt!
Who?
Fun Hat.
What is up, everyone?
Fun Hat.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun Hat.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun Hat.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go tell up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So
what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-35-501.
One half.
3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.